So contributing factors. How many contributing factors do we need in order to make a decision? How much knowledge do you actually need in order to make a decision? Because Dr. Knibbe just brought us through a whole bunch of knowledge of what's happening in your pathway of pain. How much more do we need? You see, the pathway of responsibility is a parallel pathway to the pathway of pain. If you know something, you are now automatically responsible for it. So how much knowledge do we have to continually give in order for us to make a decision to do something differently? And in order to get to a decision, we have to understand the problem right. And I want to make sure that we understand the problem right before we go down the pathway of responsibility. We are not talking about the alcoholic that sits in your basement and drinks himself into oblivion every night. That is not what we're talking about. That is an addiction that we all understand, I think. But alcohol use disorder is actually a disorder of the use of alcohol. It's binge drinking, it's teenage drinking, and it's heavy use drinking. The word disorder stands out there, right? Alcohol use disorder. What does disorder actually mean? It means a systematic disruption of neatly organized units. So if you're going to systematically disrupt something, you should use alcohol, according to the American Psychology Association, the ASA. Alcohol use disorder is using alcohol to make a mess of something. You can make a mess of your body, you can make a mess of your brain, you can make a mess of your community, your society, your family. So alcohol use disorder is when you make a mess of something. In order to understand how to make a mess, let's figure out what the systematic functioning of our brain is. Because alcohol goes to your brain. Dr. Knibbe brought us through the pathways of the body. I'd like to go through your brain just for a little while, because this is how we clearly understand what alcohol is actually doing and how it's addictive. In order to do that, I need to go back a little ways in history. And a little way, back in the 1800s, there was a man named B.F. Skinner. He's a psychologist. Psychologists do odd things. He decided to drop a rat in a cage and teach a rat how to press the lever. So, obviously, the rat runs around for a while, and finally he says, you know what, I'm going to give it food as it moves towards the lever. And then once he puts his paw on the lever, he gets more food. Finally, the rat accidentally hits the lever and gets a whole bunch of food. So B.F. Skinner wanted this rat to go towards a behavior. That's not uncommon to teaching your dog or your kids. So once the rat figured this out, what he did then was he backed off the food. He said, well, this time you don't get as much food. And this time you get less food. Until the rat had to push a lever to get one tiny kernel of food. And then he backed off the pushing of the lever. The rat had to push the lever twice. And then four times. All the way up to 10 times. What did he actually figure out? That the rat, the very behavior that he taught the rat, was the very behavior that almost killed the rat. So he taught the rat to press the lever for food, and then he gave the rat so little reward that it almost killed him. So the behavior that you learn can be the very behavior that almost kills you. That's B.F. Skinner back in the 1800s. The problem with behaviors is that every behavior is the same, whether it's positive or negative. If you have a behavior that you get rewarded for, your brain says do it again. It doesn't matter if it's positive, it doesn't matter if it's negative. Your brain is going to tell you to do it again. So, we call this shaping. In the world of psychology, you call this shaping. In the medical world, you call it shaping. How are you going to shape the brain of you, yourself, your community, your young people? You have to understand those reward pathways that Dr. Knibbe was talking about. He talked about one of the pathways, but there's actually four. And we need to understand these four pathways. And just bear with me as we go through this brain part, because we have to understand how the brain works and how we basically mess it up with alcohol. So, pathways of the brain. Your first one is your reward center. This is what Dr. Knibbe is talking about. This is a simple pleasure for something that you receive. Your kid comes up to you and gives you a hug, that feels good. That's your reward center. Your reward center kind of runs by itself. Your memory learning pathway. Can somebody please explain to me why a kid that's learning how to walk enjoys standing up and falling back on its butt 100 times a day? It doesn't make sense, right? You stand up and you fall back down. You stand up and you fall back down. Why did they do it? Because they understand the experience around what they're trying to do. And they're encouraged. We constantly encourage them to do this behavior that they fail at over and over again until they learn it. It might be a learning pathway. Motivation and drive. This is what you try to get out of your teenager. You try to teach them how to actually succeed at something with hard work. And this is usually in your teenagers. And then you have a control pathway. Some people are called control freaks. Some people love this control pathway. And a control freak is somebody who has a whole lot of stimulation out of your control pathway. We're supposed to be able to use our control pathway. This is where you make a common sense, where you make a common sense decision. This is where you decide to go buy a new field, you plant a bunch of canola, you get a bunch of money, you're going to keep doing this. This is where you make decisions. So these four pathways, the problem with all four of them is that they compete. They compete for one thing. They compete for pleasure. How do you get pleasure? You have to release dopamine. It's a chemical. And as your chemical is released in your brain, one of these pathways is going to get all of the dopamine. And if you get a dopamine in your reward center, your control center turns off. If you get dopamine in your motivation center, your reward center turns off. So you're going to get a reward out of one of these pathways. If you keep doing the same thing over and over again, you're going to be just like the rat. You do the activity, you press the lever, you have dopamine, you get pleasure, you're going to do it again. This is the fundamental understanding of addiction. It doesn't matter what your addiction is. It doesn't matter how you do it. If you repeat the same behavior and you get dopamine response in your brain, you are going to keep doing the behavior. Your behavior is literally etched into your brain. As you do the same thing over and over, it becomes a physical part of who you are. Because those neurons actually get connected. And they stay connected. You can explain this by your 2-year-old or your 1-year-old. If you put down a bowl of soup in front of your 1-year-old, what happens? It's all over them. It's all over the table. You have a 3-foot radius of peas and carrots all around you. They don't know how to eat. They have to use every part of their brain just to get the spoon into their mouth. And sure, mom's frustrated and has to clean up after them, but we keep doing this. None of us actually have to think of how to eat. Because that pathway has become a part of our brain. It is as much a physical part of your brain as your arm and your leg. And I know that because I've cut arms and legs off. Because in the hospital, in the ER, in the OR, sometimes we have to amputate. If you come in from the ER with a car accident and we have to amputate your leg, it actually isn't that hard. You have an artery, you have a vein, you have a nerve, you have a bone. Cut them in that order, you'll be perfectly fine. It isn't that difficult. The problem is, when you have something set up in your brain as a pathway, that's a physical part of who you are, I can't change it. I can't go in and fix it. For a year and a half, I did neurosurgery at Spectrum Health. I did not like it at all. Because we would spend 12, 14 hours, and we would go right in here and cut these things all apart. Looks like a new one, right? And we'd go down into the middle of your brain, and we'd spend 12, 14 hours, would finally get the tumor out, send the tumor to the pathologist. Pathologist would call us back and say, looks great, you think you got it all, patient should be good. Good, you should feel reward for that, right? You should feel good about doing neurosurgery. You go ask the doctor the next day, hey, how's the patient doing? Well, the patient woke up, they're doing okay. No, what's wrong with the patient? Well, the patient doesn't want to eat. Well, what do you mean, the patient doesn't want to eat? Why doesn't the patient want to eat? Because we broke their physical pathway inside their brain that they had set up to learn how to eat. That's why after neurosurgery, you end up with these patients that don't know how to eat, don't know how to walk, don't know how to go to the bathroom.
because these are behaviors that we have learned.
It's the same thing with Alzheimer's with dementia. As you go through Alzheimer's and dementia, all of these pathways are being destroyed. All of those pathways, those memory pathways, those learning pathways, they're all getting broken down. That's why nothing works inside. It's a physical part of who we are. And as you go through the pathways, your reward pathway and your control pathway compete for each other, right? So as your reward center continually receives high amounts of dopamine, your control center goes down. And if you look at this thing at the bottom here, this is very easily explained. And I'll explain it to you. First of all, let's see, over here in the normal brain, right?
If you're in the normal brain, you're going to look down at your sheet and say, you know what? These things are black, they're a little bit scuffed up. They're probably on the side, those are not flat in the front, they're rounded over a little bit. Maybe someday I'm going to go get a new pair of shoes. Someday I'll go find a new pair of shoes. This is my normal brain talking, this is my control center, right? But if I come over here to your addicted brain, and I'm going to say this, she looks down at her shoes and looks at her boots and says, you know what, these things are 4 days old already. I'll bet you there's another pair of boots out there that I should probably go buy. Because if I don't go buy the pair of boots, I'm not going to be the most fashionable, and these things are 4 days old. That's ridiculous. I should go out and buy them a pair of boots. And see, your control center is sitting there trying to get you to think, trying to make a rational judgment. And your control center says, yeah, but you have 67 pairs at home. And your reward center says, I don't care, 60 is better. Because it gets a reward of dopamine every time it goes out and back and buys shoes. Because that's how our brain works. Because it functions on the dopamine response and the pleasure of doing something. Same thing with shopping, same thing with eating. But when it becomes a physical part of your brain, you have a problem. So, your brain. The systematic functioning that we are now going to disrupt with alcohol is a part of who you are. If it fires together, it is going to wire together. This is how you are wired. Now I want to bring you back to this. You are wired by your behavior. Just like children, they are wired by their behavior. How do you wire things together? How do you shape a brain and make it stay together? There's only two factors. One of them is genetics. And somebody is going to say, good, you finally got here. My great-grandpa drank, my grandpa drank, my dad drinks, and I like to drink. I can't help it. I'm genetically prone to this. This is what I do. Did your great-grandma and your grandma and your mom all buy shoes too? Do you have a shoe genetic thing? Do you have a shopping genetic thing? Do you have a gene for cleaning? Do you have a gene for eating? So your genes, yeah, they make up who you are. But what do you have to do in order to become an alcoholic? There's only one thing. The behavior of picking up the alcohol and putting it in your mouth. It's a behavior. It's not your genes. I don't care how genetically prone you are to alcohol, if you never pick it up and never put it in your mouth, you're not going to be addicted to alcohol. It's that simple. So you can blame your genes, and you can say you're genetically modified or genetically prone to it. And I will give a little bit of genetic excuse to about 1 to 2% of anybody in this room. 1 to 2% of people in this room will have a genetic predisposition that when they do the behavior, and again, if they didn't do the behavior, they won't have this problem. When they do the behavior of drinking alcohol, they have a dopamine flush that is 100 times greater than it is now. And when that dopamine flush comes, their reward center completely shuts down their control center, and now they're completely addicted. That's your genetic alcoholic. That is not binge drinking. That is not teen drinking, and that is not heavy drinking. That is not alcohol use disorder. That is something completely different. So if you can't blame your genetics,
What are you going to blame for alcohol use disorder? It's a behavior. So there's contributing factors to this behavior. All behaviors have contributing factors. And there's really four contributing factors. Your family, your friends, those stupid social groups on Facebook and all those other things, and access. If you don't have a family that drinks, you probably won't drink. If you don't have friends that don't drink, you probably won't drink. If you don't have social groups that think drinking is cool, you probably won't think it's cool and go drink. And if there's no liquor in your city, you can't get it. You're not going to drink. So those are your contributing factors. That is what leads you or gives you the ability to actually go out and do the behavior of drinking. In my life, when I'm not here having fun, I had to be at home running a cardiac center. At Spectrum House, we do about 50 to 1800 open heart surgeries a year. We do about 3000 vascular surgeries a year. And I like it. I have fun. 80 to 100 people that you have to coordinate. Every open heart procedure is about 1000 steps. I get to stick my hand in your chest and manipulate your heart. I get to make sure that when you are done with your heart surgery, you hopefully leave the hospital. All of this has to happen in perfect increment. I get a dopamine flush when that patient gets to walk out of the hospital feeling good. And I want to show you what contributing factors are. I want to prove a point here. If I like and I get a dopamine flush, and my job and my paycheck and my family and my welfare depends on people having cardiac surgery, then clearly I should set up contributing factors in Grand Rapids to make sure everybody has cardiac surgery. That makes perfect sense to me. It's my job, and I get a paycheck. So I want everybody in Grand Rapids to have cardiac surgery. So we are going to start a new program. And Dr. Panibi has agreed to help me with this program. And we are going to make sure that everybody, when you go to your doctor's office, gets a deep fryer. And we're going to make sure that you have a whole bunch of fatty acid oil to stick in there. And we want you to deep fry everything. Because I know, I have the knowledge, that behavior will make sure that you end up with cardiac surgery. And I'm going to make sure that you drink a whole bunch of soda and you go out and eat all the time and that you drink and eat all this fatty stuff. I want to build that program. I want more cardiac surgery. Please, make sure your kids don't eat anything green and leafy, because we know that reduces your ability to have cardiac surgery. So please, get rid of the vegetables, listen to your kids. Your kids are going to love us tomorrow. Because I mean, love us tomorrow. Organics. Months organics, out the door, okay? Get rid of the organic stuff. It's a fact. It's nothing else. You need to shop in the middle of your grocery store with all that processed food with that MSG and all that other junk in there, because that's going to hurt your liver and your kidneys, and it's going to increase your blood pressure, and you're going to end up with cardiac surgery. Because remember, I get a dopamine flush for doing the behavior of cardiac surgery. Please, do not go outside. Do not exercise. That is the number one way to reduce your actual risk of cardiac disease. And make sure that you and your kids sit on the bed of the couch together. Do not share the bag of potato chips. One for each. And please, do not go see Dr. Panibi, because he's probably going to tell you that I'm full of malarkey and I shouldn't be doing this. Wait until you're old enough and you have a lot of chest pain. And don't be surprised when you have a heart attack. Because I need my manager to grow my program. You see, I think that very few of you are going to come to Grand Rapids. I mean, the U.S. system is pretty cool. It's way better than the Canadian system. And what we're also going to do is we're going to charge you $150,000. So, contributing factors. I'm contributing through all of these behaviors to have cardiac disease because I'm living. So, what are we going to do to contribute to alcohol use disorder? You see, these are behaviors that end up with the disease process. How are we going to give behaviors to alcohol use disorder?
we can do that much the same, because you can set up a really awesome project.
You should start young. Make sure that your kids, when they're really young, are drinking alcohol. Make sure they see it. Make sure it's around them. Make sure they see absolutely nothing wrong with alcohol. You know, the guy on the left, he's got it down. The guy on the right, he needs to get a little bit of work on him, right? You can't suck alcohol up like this. You gotta get the muscle coming up. By the time you're 10 to 12, they got it figured out, right? And parents, just look the other way. Just let them do whatever they want to do. Let them drink. It doesn't matter. Just, if you want an alcohol use disorder, make sure that your kids get it young and do it often. And you know what's even better? You should give them access to it. Remember, access was one of those factors, right? Make sure that your farm, your barn, your backyard, whatever you want, is open for them to come drink alcohol whenever they want. Because we are trying to promote alcohol use disorder. This is how you contribute to it. Just like cardiac disease. And I know you're Dutch. Buy your beer when it's on sale and stock up for it. Make sure that you have everything possible because your kids are going to want to drink this and be addicted to it. This is how you contribute to alcohol use disorder. And do me one more favor. Make sure that the people who do this the best, whether your parents or whether your kids, are super popular. Because when you're popular for drinking, you will drink twice as much and read twice as much in your brain. Because being popular, everybody likes that. And when this happens, don't be surprised. I mean, be surprised, don't be surprised. We've contributed to alcohol use disorder. We should expect this to happen. Just like when you contribute to cardiac disorders, you should expect a heart attack. Am I a terrible, irresponsible, worthless nurse for contributing to cardiac disease the way I said I was going to do that? Am I a terrible, irresponsible, maybe not worthless, parent for contributing to alcohol use disease? Common sense indicates that if we do the behaviors that we know are going to lead to the outcome, just like the rat, then we are completely shunning our responsibility. Our responsibility is not to set up these pathways in our brain, these reward centers that are a physical part of who you are, that are going to lead you to be addicted to anything. That is not our responsibility. Rather, we should be looking at how to prevent these behaviors. We shouldn't be looking at how to promote these behaviors. And I know it was kind of a humorous way of looking at it, but to look at it seriously from the other side, a pathway of responsibility. If we know that the outcome of what we are supposed to do, and we know that the outcome of what we are not supposed to do, then we should do what we're supposed to do. And maybe you're going to see this as a very simple slide, but I want you to think about it. Choose your friends carefully. The first thing you should be doing. If you are always going to somebody's house on Friday night that has a whole bunch of hard liquor coming out after supper time, and it's just what they do, that's who they are, that's how it goes, why do you go there? Why do you bring your kids there? Choose your friends carefully. Find the people that you can associate with, and find the people that your children should associate with to make this go away. Learn about the consequences. When you learn about the consequences, hopefully like you have done tonight, you have the responsibility to do something. Doing nothing is not an option. Well, it is an option. We'll get to that later. Learn about the consequences. Make sure that you understand what is happening in your body and in your brain. If you want your children to know and be completely addicted, then just stick your head in the sand, and then it'll probably happen. I have a news flash for you. You did not graduate out of peer pressure when you graduated from high school. Parental peer pressure is almost greater than the peer pressure that you've had in this. Peer pressure and the ability to deal with it or to manage it is a learned behavior. If you were a person in school that really had to be at the top of your class and all you wanted to be was the most cool person, you're probably the same thing as an adult. I mean, maybe you're married and maybe your other half is helping you out with it, but for the most part, that is a learned behavior. We have to learn how to deal with the peer pressure of this social acceptance of an addictive behavior. The parents, if we give the reward of social acceptance to our children, the dopamine release is stronger than the alcohol itself. If you are cool because you drink, or you are a cool parent because you allow your children to drink, both you and your children will somehow gain status within a community, and you will become addicted to gaining status. Do you get status by knowing every single wine and beer and alcohol underneath the sun? And what about those people who don't know anything about alcohol? Do they lose status? Peer pressure within a community has to be talked about, has to be put on the table, and we have to understand it as one of the most powerful addictive responses. If you are addicted to something, you are going to automatically have peer pressure within a community, within people, doesn't matter. Whether it's eating, whether it's shopping, whether it's cleaning. If you're addicted to cleaning, what about those people who don't clean? They immediately become less than you. There's always going to be a divide. And remember, you are putting a neural pathway inside your children. This is a generational problem. If we as parents accept this and do this, we should expect our children to do exactly the same thing. And when you have their brains wired, and when they are fully counting on being the most cool kid in the school because they can throw the best party, you are giving them nothing more than a wired brain that's going to lead to complete chaos. What's the last thing? Avoid starting young. Your 13-year-old, your 14-year-old, let's just be honest, if there's anyone here who's 13 or 14, I'll pick on you, but for real, they're a hot mess, right? You're 13 or 14, you got hormones everywhere. You're just still trying to figure out whether or not your control function even works on how to make a decision. What in the world are we doing putting alcohol in their mess? Why would we ever, while the brains are still developing, trying to figure out which pathway should be used, why would you ever put alcohol in there and shut the pathways down? And make them addicted to one substance that is going to keep them addicted probably for a lifetime. And we're talking about binge drinking and teenage drinking and heavy drinking, not the alcohol that's sitting in their bathroom in their basement. Why would we introduce something that is going to completely shut down their brain and wire them for the rest of their life? It has a huge impact on the outcome of who you are going to be in society. To every pathway, there's roadblocks, right? What is it that stands in the way of doing something when you know all of this stuff? When you know it's going to hurt your body, when you know it's going to physically change the brain of your children and you, and as a collective society, what stands in the way? The greatest enemy to any addictive behavior is apathy. I guarantee you, if you don't care, you are not going to do anything. What happens when apathy becomes a learned behavior? Because you see, being apathetic is a learned behavior. What if apathy is rewarded? So if I'm going to reward your apathy, you're going to get a dopamine response for being completely apathetic and walking out of here and doing absolutely nothing. And you're going to feel good about that. You see how you get an alcohol use disorder? See, now we're really disrupting things. Now we're creating disorder within a community because apathy is the lack of the use of your control center. Because you're not going to make a decision to do anything different because you just don't care. So you see how you end up with another layer of problem. And maybe you say, well, the people that actually don't care, the apathetic people, they stayed home tonight. There are those people sitting in the front row over there. What about the rest of us, right? Some people care about the problem in the community. Some people care about their own problem. You care about your own problem. If you like a lot of beer, you like to drink a lot of hard liquor, and you don't see anything wrong with team drinking, you should care about it. And when you care about it, there's always these people that say, well, we can't do anything about it. We try not to be part of it, we try not to do it, but we can't do a single thing about it. And these people, and the other people, they're not going to do anything about it. They don't care. They didn't show up. So what happens between the we's and the they's? You end up with complete hopelessness that leads you to a cynical and apathetic behavior. Because there's nothing that we can do about it, there's nothing they are going to do about it. And even though I care about it, even though I think it's a problem, I'm completely apathetic about the whole thing because I can't do anything about it. The school can't do anything about it. Church can't do anything about it. You see, apathy goes a long ways. What happens when you have an apathetic response, whether it's out of concern or blaming apathy? You're apathetic in school. What's more important, the party or your math test? You're apathetic in catechism class. What's more important, learning your questions or having another reader? You end up apathetic about doctrine. Why would you learn your doctrine? You end up apathetic about it. You see, it's a community thing. When you have an addictive behavior, whether it's eating, whether it's pornography, it doesn't matter what it is. When the addictive behavior becomes a social behavior, and you have a social apathy, then you have a complete disruption. Community health. What are you going to do as a community? You know, I can sit there and read this for you, and maybe you think that it's a little bit, whatever, build strong relationships. Yeah, of course. I want to give you an example of a group of people, group of parents in Grand Rapids who were very concerned. They were very concerned about the addiction to the cell phone. So in third grade, all of the parents and the third graders got together and they decided that they were going to sign a contract amongst all of those parents that said that their children were not going to receive a cell phone until they were 17. That's exciting. So it means a long time. And what did? They held each other accountable to this contract. And it started out actually with only two parents. Two parents started doing this. They started talking to the other parents, and then they had five, and then they had ten. And finally, they got the whole class. What actually happened in that class? That third grade went all the way through school and got to 11th grade before they got any phones. Americans are usually maybe not Canadians. 11th grade or 17. And they got it all the way there, and not a single one of them had a cell phone. And not a single one of them cared. And they thought they were cool. They thought the people around them that were sitting on cell phones on Friday nights around the campfire, because that's just what people do now. You sit in a room and you pull out your phone and look at your phone. You don't talk to each other. They thought that was dumb. Because their brains were wired to think that this behavior of not having a cell phone and not looking at it all the time was a good behavior. You do not have to be in the majority of people caring about a problem to fix it. The minority rules here. If you get a couple of people together, you have a strong community, and you do something, you can change behaviors. What about the people? Let's say you like to drink, you have no problem with it, and you have no plans to do anything different, whether you're young or old, it doesn't matter. The people who absolutely do not like to drink, where are they? Do they fit in anywhere?
Or do we shame the people that actually think that this is a problem? Do we shame the people who don't go to the parties? The young people who don't show up to the party, are you shamed? Are you pushed into a corner? Or are you free to talk about it? Is it more shame to do well in your math test or to go to a party or not go to a party? You see, shame is one of the most powerful disruptions within a community. And this is for everything. If we're going to talk about shame, where does shame end up? It's another learned behavior. It's actually not as much of a learned behavior as an associated behavior. What about the fat kid or fourth kid that gets shamed in the corner? You see him out in the playground. Where is he? He's completely silent. He has nothing more to say. They have nothing left. Because shame is going to shut your mouth every time. Go yell at your teenage kid who did something wrong, who's ashamed of what they did. They're going to look at it before and not talk to you. Because shame is going to drive you into silence. Do not shame people in your community around any addictive behavior. And if you are, and if you're in that silence, what are you going to say? What is there left to say? If shame is a learned behavior, if apathy is learned behavior, what is there left to say? Now, I'd like to leave you tonight with a quote from Cotton Mather. Cotton Mather is the author of a book called The Family Well Ordered. He was a Puritan in the 1700s, and he had a very good saying, and if you want to, you can read this book. But I want to leave you with this book. I beseech you, parents, interpose your authority to stop and check the carriage of your children when they are running into the paths of the destroyer. Gratify them with rewards of well-doing when they do well. Do that. Gratify them with rewards of well-doing when they do well. But do not let them be gratified with every ungodly vanity that their vain minds may set upon. Keep strict inspection upon their conversations. Examine how they spend their time. Examine what company they keep. Examine whether they take any bad courses. What shame is there in that? There is no shame in doing that. There is no apathy in that. That is our responsibility. If you know where alcohol use is going to lead you or lead us, then this is what we should be doing. Use your authority. Watch your shame. Care for your children. Then I want to leave you with this quote. Let your charge be from Proverbs 9, verse 6. Forsake the foolish and live. Charge them, your children, to avoid the snares of evil company. Terrify them with warnings of those deadly snares. Often repeat this charge unto them. If there is any vicious company, shun them as you would the plague or the devil. Often say, my son, if sinners entice thee, consent thou not. Often say, my child, walk with the wise and thou shalt be wise. But a companion of fools shall be destroyed. Thank you.